This is the Criminal Law Podcast on the topic of causation. And where causation is an issue in prosecutions is when the particular crime requires some type of result, and where you see most, although certainly not all, but where you see most of the causation issues arise are in murder or homicide prosecutions, because that's the situation where it may not be clear what the particular cause of death was or whether the defendant was responsible for that cause of death or should be held responsible for whatever the particular cause of death was. But more generally, it's for any type of result crime. And so you could have, for example, in a fraud offense where the victim has to be deprived of property, that deprivation as a result, and the defendant would have to cause that. Causation is an element of every crime that involves a result, but it is often not an issue where, or at least it's not a contested issue, that causation is quite easy to see. Now, there are two steps in the causation analysis, and the best way to approach this is to do them in this order. First, was the defendant a cause in fact of the result? And when we look at it in the context of a homicide offense, was the defendant the cause of the death of the victim? This is the but-for causation. Was this person in the line of causation that led to the death of the victim? And the analysis is, because of the defendant's conduct, it is, and this is the Model Penal Code language, Model Penal Code Section 2.031A, that it is an antecedent, so it has to come earlier in time, but for which the result would not have occurred when it occurred. So that under this analysis, that did the defendant cause the death at a particular point in time before the person would have died anyway? Everyone is going to die, so, but did your conduct lead to the person's death at that particular point in time? What this analysis highlights is that you can have a theory of homicide that involves accelerating the death of the victim, and technically that's true in every homicide case. Everyone is going to die, so you have accelerated the death, but you can have the situation where one person causes an injury that will lead to the victim's death at a particular point in time, then a second defendant comes along and causes an injury that leads to immediate death. So the person may have been injured by a particular wound and would have died within 48 hours. Another defendant comes along and immediately kills the victim. Both can be held liable for the homicide, so that you can have one victim, but two defendants charged with the crime. Now, this is an element of the offense, and the government is required to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. The Lane case is an example in which the government put on enough evidence so that the jury could find the defendant guilty, but it's certainly not overwhelming evidence. This is the situation in which the defendant swung and struck the victim, who was highly intoxicated, who fell to the ground, and then about 12, 14, 16 hours later was brought to the hospital and died because of injuries to his head and to his brain. And the issue was there enough evidence to show that the defendant was a but-for cause? Well, the government introduced proof that the defendant struck the victim and the victim fell to the ground. They aren't able to show that the victim hit his head on the pavement or a curb or something like that, but certainly that blow to the head could be sufficient, and there was expert testimony that a blow to the head led to the victim's death. The defendant offered the theory that, well, maybe something else caused the death. When he was in jail, perhaps he hit his head, stumbled again, but that's all speculative. The defendant didn't put on any evidence, and the government did put on evidence from which a rational jury could have concluded that the defendant caused the death, and therefore the conviction in that case was upheld. Now, the key in, especially in the homicide cases, when you're trying to determine what was the cause of death, is medical testimony, medical expert testimony, will often be required. And the Oxendine case provides a very good example of a situation in which you did have expert testimony as to who caused the death of the child in this case. The standard is, as the Delaware court explained, that the medical expert testimony has to be not just a possibility, but to a reasonable medical certainty, this particular conduct or this particular blow, whatever it happens to be, led to the death of the victim. And you'll note in the Oxendine case, the two government experts weren't able to identify Jeffrey Oxendine Sr.'s blows as leading to the death of his son. Now, there was a defense expert for his co-defendant who did testify that the Jeffrey Sr.'s blows did lead to the boy's death, but that was not introduced in the government's case in chief. Oxendine is a very good example not only of what you need from the medical expert, which is testimony to a reasonable medical certainty that this was the cause of the death, here the but-for cause, but also it must be introduced by the government in its case in chief. If the government doesn't introduce sufficient evidence in its case in chief to convict the defendant, then the charge must be dismissed, in this case the involuntary manslaughter charge. He was still held liable for an assault charge. But that standard, again, for the medical testimony or any testimony about the cause is to a reasonable certainty. Do you know for sure? No. But the government must prove the element beyond a reasonable doubt, and the testimony must be to a reasonable medical certainty if you're talking about a medical expert. The other aspect of causation, if the defendant is a but-for cause, the defendant is not, the case doesn't go further. If the defendant is, then there is the issue of proximate cause, which really focuses on the narrow issue of, is there an intervening cause that relieves the defendant of responsibility for whatever the result is for the particular prosecution. In a homicide prosecution, relieves the defendant of liability for the death of the victim. And as explained in, or as set out in the Model Penal Code, this analysis is that if the actual result involves the same kind of injury, that it is not too remote or accidental. What the law talks about here is you have intervening causes that are, some are foreseeable, whether they're unforeseeable, whether they are coincidental. What this really is an analysis or a decision by the jury of, is this particular cause enough here to permit the jury to find that the defendant should not be held responsible? Now, anything could be an intervening cause, but the Lamprey case is a good example that courts set a pretty high barrier here, do set a high barrier for finding an intervening cause cuts off the liability of the defendant, who is certainly a but-for cause and bears significant responsibility for the ultimate result. In Lamprey, she was driving the kids home in the back of the truck and did, apparently, at least the government alleged, swervies. She claimed that she was trying to avoid a dog and that there were mechanical problems and that that was the intervening cause. The issue in Lamprey is the jury instruction, where the court said that that intervening cause had to be the sole cause. It couldn't be just one factor in the death, but had to be the sole substantial cause of the death of the victim. In that case, it would cut off liability. And so you see the court here setting a high standard that once this but-for causation and the defendant's involvement in the death or in the result is established, then it's a high threshold, and you will find that these types of proximate causation arguments are very difficult to win, but certainly not impossible if you can identify an intervening cause. Now, not every intervening cause will be the basis to relieve the defendant of liability. And that's the State versus Pelham case, where the victim, after being badly injured in the automobile accident, chose to end his life and in a perfectly permissible way because it was on a respirator, extraordinary life support system, and the decision was made to end the person's life. Pelham, the defendant who had injured the victim in the automobile accident in which he was drunk, said, well, that's an intervening cause. And note that the New Jersey Supreme Court said, no, we're going to that's precluded completely as an intervening cause. Why? Well, notice the effect here. If there is a sufficient intervening cause, if it is meets the applicable legal standard to be an intervening cause, the defendant is not liable for the death. So proximate causation, this analysis or this defense, in effect, that's offered by a defendant, that there is an intervening cause in the line of causation. The defendant's still the but-for cause, but there is an intervening cause that relieves the defendant of liability. Then, in that situation, the defendant receives a not guilty verdict. That is a substantial effect from this argument, and courts are hostile to it. They are not favorable toward intervening cause arguments or proximate cause arguments. This is a jury issue, ultimately. The decision for the jury whether there is enough there, but again, note in the Pelham case, the court simply precludes using a proximate cause argument by the defendant when the victim is permitted to, in effect, choose his own death. So the first step is but-for causation. If the defendant is a but-for cause, and notice there could be a number of but-for causes of a death, but the defendant is a but-for cause, and then the issue is there an intervening cause, and is it something that is so remote or accidental in model penal code language that the defendant should not be held liable?